Charles Simpson, Reel 13. I think you wanted to add something about make and mend.
Yes. A make and mend afternoon in any kind of ship produced an uncanny feeling of quiet. Those who were not asleep had previously been threatened with death if they made a noise. So 95% of any activity, like writing a letter or playing a game of cards with a friend, was conducted in silence. And in a small ship like a destroyer, there would be utter silence throughout the ship, unless you chanced to pass by a bathroom when somebody might be making the noise with the laundry, or somebody might let go a swear word when he's lost the hand of cards. But otherwise, it was a period of Sunday afternoon quiet.
Did make and mend apply to officers as well?
No. Not in the sense that they could be given permission by the captain to do what they wished within the confines of the ship. No. Officers' spare time was determined completely by any demands made on it by the head of department or the captain himself.
Can you tell me about Sunday divisions?
Sunday divisions was a ceremony that some people hated, but some people took curious pride in. It was a time in peacetime when everybody paraded in their very best uniforms and wore medals on the exceptionally ceremonial Sundays. But in peacetime, Sunday morning was devoted to divisions and church. You paraded in your own departmental group in your best uniform, and the captain passed around the upper deck and actually inspected each individual rating in the group. You were then dismissed and piped to church. And although church even then was not actually compulsory, there was a unwritten law that if you were not on duty, you went to church. So Roman Catholics, when in harbour, were excused attending a Church of England sermon on board. So Roman Catholics would be piped to catch the boat and go wherever Roman Catholics congregated. Whereas those who professed to be Church of England or were actually members of the Church of England went to the quarterdeck. And a chaplain, if the ship was big enough to have one, and not all ships had a chaplain, in which case the service would be conducted by the captain. Most of my ships had a chaplain. And then you would have a perfectly ordinary Church of England Sunday morning service. Not a communion, of course. if a ship was big enough to possess a chapel, which would be a very tiny space with some modest amount of church decoration, then the chaplain would have purely private services for those who wish to take communion. But normal morning service was a very happy morning Church of England hymn singing service. We read the lessons. Now, however reluctant he might have been to go to church in the first place, and even have a grumble as he was going to it, once he got there, there was no more enthusiastic hymn singer than your average seaman. So every hymn was sung as loudly as it could be, depending upon whether you had an orchestra provided by the band, or a piano, or an organ played by some accomplished shipmate.
What were services like on the Belfast?
Very good. The priest was a very devout priest, as well as being a very active, loyal and compassionate chaplain. He wore no uniform. It was traditional for a naval chaplain to go around dressed in a sombre civilian suit. It was recognisable as the chaplain's uniform, but it was not a naval uniform. Whereas chaplains in the army and the Royal Air Force had rank. They were captains, majors in the army, dependent upon their seniority as chaplains. Now, the tradition for a naval chaplain is that not being a naval officer, but being pretend recognized as a civilian priest, he was free to go where he wished, when he wished. So he was able, on his own inclination, to wander into anybody's mess as a priest.
I want to ask you now about the duties of the Belfast when you were an officer on board. You mentioned a little while ago that you joined the Belfast in Devonport. Can you tell me what happened after the Belfast left Devonport?
Yes. Being a, to all intents and purposes, a new ship, it had been badly damaged. Its keel had been broken. So, part of the work was to separate the ship and to introduce a new centre part. So, in all but name, she was a new ship. Such a long time had elapsed between her being damaged and actually being commissioned again that entirely new forms of armour had been introduced. Guns, torpedoes, launchers of all kinds of armament had been introduced. The type of radar was an entirely new one and was very, very important. So we had to do everything that a brand new ship would have done. Individual bits of machinery had to be tested to their maximum capacity, brought to the state in which they would be employed in wartime when actually engaged in war. full power trial had to be even more stringent than in peacetime. In other words, it was prolonged for an hour or so longer than would have been necessary in peacetime. The ship was manoeuvred by helm and by makeshift helm, as it would have been if damaged in gunfire from an enemy ship, which would not have been required in peacetime. So our trial period was several weeks longer than would have been necessary in peacetime. But when the captain was completely satisfied and inspection officers sent by Admiralty were completely happy that the ship was now ready for war, then we proceeded to Scapa Flow and became a flagship. Almost immediately, an admiral was embarked. Now, it has to be remembered that there could be several ships of the same kind. When in company, were referred to as a squadron. An admiral had control sometimes over several ships, and in our particular case, Admiral Burnett had control over several cruisers, though not all of the same design. Belfast was the only one of its particular type. Norfolk and Shropshire were cruisers, but particular, absolutely different in appearance, design, but almost approximate in speed. So had the Belfast been damaged, the Admiral and his entire staff would have left the Belfast and gone to another ship of the same type.
After the trials had been completed, where did the Belfast go?
Off we went to the north of Scotland, which was recognised as the main base for the Home Fleet. We spent only very limited time for very short leave periods and, unhappily, any repairs required in our home port.
Once you got to Scapa Flow, did you stay there for very long, or were you sent out to protect convoys?
Yes, our duty was to protect convoys, or to be ready at the Commander-in-Chief's order to look for and engage the enemy. This famous expression was the one that triggered off the chase of an enemy ship. The Admiral would issue a signal, pursue and engage the enemy. Then each Admiral then assembled would take over the rest of his squadron and pursue to sea in pursuit of the Admiral, having been already informed the course to take by the Commander-in-Chief.
I want to ask you about the time that the Belfast was escorting Arctic convoys.
Yes.
Can you tell me about some of the convoys that you escorted?
They were, the Belfast being a home fleet ship, not required except in a dire emergency to go outside of British waters, referred to as home waters, The Belfast then was confined to the Atlantic, and although we were accompanying convoys, our particular duty was to protect the convoy from a distance, to be ready to engage enemy ships intent upon sinking ships of the convoy. So our duty was to leave the convoy, if required, to go and chase an enemy ship and engage it with gunfire and sink it.
What was life like on board the Belfast during the time that you were escorting convoys in the Arctic?
Well, there were no more duties and no less duties to perform. Whatever your overall duty was once you left harbour, you have to remember that you were constantly under fear of enemy attack from submarine or aircraft or long-distance gunfire. Now, this was the same in harbour or at sea. So, the state of affairs in a ship was no different, whatever the particular duty the ship was performing once it left harbour.
I'm thinking about the weather conditions, perhaps. How did you cope with the cold weather?
The cold weather was a menace. It was a handicap which each ship suffering from Arctic conditions underwent without prior preparation. To the best of my knowledge and belief, nobody anticipated the conditions that all ships would suffer during the Arctic convoys. In peacetime, you passed happily from home waters to Arctic waters in good weather and not in the depths of winter. Now, during war, you went wherever required, whatever the weather. And so the Arctic convoys have since become world famous because we shadowed convoys in the foulest of Arctic weather, whatever that weather brought. 40 feet waves, sea temperatures below zero, ice forming on the upper works, ice 3 and 4 inches thick, which had to be chipped by hand. At the beginning of the Arctic convoys, the conditions had been unforeseen. So the precautions we took and the action we took when ice formed was somewhat amateur.
What precautions did you take and what actions?
When we became accustomed, we introduced measures to defeat ice. The ship's company, principally the coppersmith among the artificers, led steam pipes around positions where personnel were exposed to the Arctic conditions. The purpose of which was a faint hope of providing some warmth around places like the bridge. But as the war progressed and as the condition became known, then ships were detached to be provided with dockyard introduced things to defeat the ice that formed on exposed places.
How did you get rid of the ice once it had formed?
Well, in the early stages, ice forming on gun barrels was chipped off by hand with little hammers. Artificial warmth was provided by whatever way the ship's engineers, the electrical engineers, could provide.
I've heard that steam was used to melt the ice.
Once we got used to it, and it took a week or two to realise what a hazard a great deal of ice on the upper deck provided. It altered the centre of gravity of the ship. When the chance of it being heeled over to a dangerous degree became very, very obvious, then we provided open steam from the engine room spaces. That became the responsibility of my department.
Whose idea was that?
Well, we provided armoured hoses and led steam through them to an open-ended pipe. And when required to switch on, a stoker would open the necessary valve. And like a modern-day steam cleaning bit of apparatus. But later on, the means of defeating ice was provided at the where the ice was formed. Down below, icicles 4 feet long hung from the ventilation. It was necessary to provide the boiler rooms with air under pressure to feed the boiler sprayers. This was provided by very powerful fans from the upper deck. So it was ice cold. So stokers down below had to wear Arctic clothing whilst in charge of the boilers. And I discovered quite early in the Arctic convoys that icicles 4 feet long could hang from the ventilation trunkings. So I issued an order that when watches were changed and personnel came down into the boiler room, they were to dislodge any icicles hanging from the ventilation trunking, because a 4 foot long icicle descending on the chief stoker's head would have killed him outright.
Was the clothing that you had been issued with adequate for these conditions?
My guess would have been no, because it became known by watching people who were employed in exposed positions that they not only wore their normal uniform, but they added items of clothing to it. So on top of their normal hard weather clothing, they put the Arctic clothing, which was very rapidly provided once it was known just how horrible the conditions in the Arctic were. So any seaman exposed to the Arctic climate sitting in a gun position looked like a comic character. He looked as though he was walking with his head out of a tent. No, this had one terrible consequence. It never happened in the Belfast whilst I was there, but other ships were sunk when in the Arctic, and it was an acknowledged hazard that if a person went over the deck, over into the sea, in his exposed position clothing, he died within, it was estimated, 4 seconds. So, one of the horrors of the Arctic conditions was that if you went over the side due to enemy action or any other hazard, your death was immediate.
You said that as time went on, that precautions against ice became more sophisticated. Can you explain how that, what those precautions entailed?
Yes, they either wrapped an electrical object producing heat, or they provided very much more steam piping than the ship's coppersmith had been able to provide when the demand was first made. Can we have a steam pipe around the bridge? So from a very limited professional ability to a dockyard provision, you move from something that a plumber could have provided to what the dockyard resources could provide. It was much the same when they sought a protection against a German torpedo that exploded on contact, when every ship went in to be provided with an electrical deterrent, when they wrapped cables around the ship's hull, and this generated some kind of electrical energy.
I want to go on to talk about the action that the Belfast saw during the Second World War. First of all, on the Arctic convoys, can you remember any particular incidents?
Yes. Belfast played, as history now tells, a prominent part in the sinking of the German battleship Scharnhorst. The particular ability of Belfast to develop very high speed, 34 knots, exceeding 37 miles per hour, and to maintain that speed for a very long time, was coupled with its ability, with its brand new radar, to track the progress of an enemy ship from a very much longer distance than other warships. So, Belfast, with its admiral, was able to obey the instructions of the commander-in-chief of the Home Fleet to pursue the Scharnhorst, which had a speed even greater than that of the Belfast. But nevertheless, the Belfast was probably amongst the best of the ships to look for and pursue the Charnels.
Charles Simpson, Reel 14.